Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when you're on the edge financially, one setback can be disastrous. We'll learn about a Wisconsin program that provides financial advice and support for low-income single mothers.
First, the State Department of Natural Resources has released the results of tests done on the Trempealeau River near the city of Whitehall after an accident at a frac sand mine in May.
10 million gallons of liquid from a sand washing pond were released as part of a rescue operation and flowed into nearby fields and waterways. The DNR's tests now are giving us a better idea of what possible impact the spill could have on the area's environment.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been covering this story. Rich, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first off, take us back to May 21st. What happened at the High Crush Frac Sand Mine that led to the spill?
So what happened was an operator who was driving a bulldozer was, according to some fines that were issued by the Mine Safety and Health Organization, or agency, was pushing sand into or towards this holding pond that holds water that is recycled and reused, water that is used to wash the clays and the fine sediment from the frac sand grains. And the earth beneath him gave way, and the bulldozer slid into the pond, was completely submerged underwater for about 2.5 hours. During this time, this gentleman was able to communicate via radio, and the cab was somewhat filling up with water, but it remained airtight, so he was able to breathe. But it must have been a terrifying experience. So when they realized that divers couldn't find the tractor or the bulldozer, they decided that they needed to drain the pond. So they used excavators to basically rip up one of the dikes that was holding the water in the pond. And then those 10 million gallons made their way to a nearby creek, flooded some farm fields and some driveway. And then that water eventually turned the Trempealeau River orange, because there was a lot of really fine sediment that stayed suspended. And that water moved on down the Trempealeau River towards the Mississippi.
So before we get into any more on the environmental impact, the worker that was rescued, he was okay, right?
Yeah, he was able to, they checked him out, but he was not injured. There were a couple of injuries. I believe it had to do with fatigue. Some of the first responders were treated and released, but no major injuries involved.
So let's talk about the water that was in this holding pond. You said this was water that is used, it's recycled, it's reused. What else might be in this water that we know of?
Sure. So the company has been pretty open about the fact that there's something in there. It's a chemical called a polyacrylamide. And what that is it's known as a flocculant. So when this sand is washed, they break up the sandstone, bring it to the plant, they crush it up and process it, and they need to separate this clay and silt and mud from the grains of sand that they want to, you know, separate. And this water gets really orange and mucky. So the flocculant is added to the water, and what the flocculant does is it causes all those sediments to kind of clump together and get heavy enough that they settle out so that they can reuse the water and not have, you know, muddy water going back in to wash the sand. So this pond, basically, the company said it contains, you know, sand, silt, clay, and they also mentioned polyacrylamide, but that has been a concern of some citizens that live nearby, because polyacrylamide, while it is used for water treatment plants, I mean, it's used to deal with drinking water, in every batch there is a small trace amount of what is called acrylamide, and that is a neurotoxin. So the concern is that this material, once it, you know, the concern among citizens, I should say, is that possibly this small trace is kind of adding up and concentrating, but there have been, as far as I know, there haven't been any detections of acrylamide or polyacrylamide in the water that was released.
And let's talk about that water. As far as I know, that went into a creek, that went into the Trempealeau River. Do we have a sense of the spread, how far this has gone at this point?
Well, it seems to be, by now, it's hard to say, because the test results that we're getting, first we got test results, the media, that is, they sent them within the last couple of weeks. We got test results from May 21st, which was hours after the event was happening, so that water was still entering the creek, from what I understand. And this is an unnamed creek along what's called Poker Cooley Road, which is kind of in between Whitehall and Independence. And that creek then flows into the Trampolo River. So people that I you know, communicate with, my sources, I guess, living in the area, have been reporting that it turned the Trampolo River orange, and that the they called it the plume, had made it all the way down to Perot State Park, and that's where the Trampolo River meets the Mississippi River. So it made it all the way down to the Mississippi and you know, wherever else. The DNR has been taking some samples from the Mississippi, but the levels of metals have been pretty low there.
We are talking right now with Rich Kramer. He's our WPR reporter based in Eau Claire, talking about some water from a frac sand mine that found its way into some waterways. And, Rich, you had mentioned that we're getting some new information about some samples that the DNR, they did some tests recently, in recent days after the spill. We're finding out more this week about the results of those tests. What are we hearing?
Well, the first round of tests that were taken May 21st, the results, as you would expect, where the flow of material actually entered the creek, what we've learned is that there were high concentrations of metals in there, including arsenic, copper, mercury, etc. And that's to be expected because these metals are naturally occurring in the sandstone that is being dug up and processed. And because they recycle the water, the companies do to save money, and also it's just standard practice, those metals seem to have been concentrated. So the May 21st results that we got showed that, for example, let's go with copper. There was 2,340 parts per billion, which is a lot higher than the formula for what is considered acute toxicity or dangerous to, you know, fish and other wildlife in the water. That criteria is about 73, so it was way over. But samples taken downstream on the 21st showed that whether it be from dilution or else because the sediment was leaving the water and kind of piling up on the bottom, none of the other samples from down the creek or down the Trampolo River had acute toxic levels on the 21st. So the test results that we got just this week came from the 23rd, which is 2 days after the event. There was one incidence of acute toxicity. That was, again, where the spill had first entered the unnamed creek. So other than that, the levels of metals, the metals are present, but they're low enough that it's not considered harmful to aquatic life.
And well, what about human life? What about, I would imagine that some in the area might rely on some of these waterways for drinking water. Is there a sense here, are you hearing anything that humans may be at risk in any way, shape, or form?
Well, from what I understand, most people in the area, if not all, get their drinking water. I mean, and I got this, you know, the DNR has told me this, and also I've spoken with some experts who are unrelated to this issue in one way or the other. And they said that generally, you know, people get their water from wells, drinking groundwater. And because of this, the topography and the geology and the whole way the whole system works, the groundwater tends to come up and go into the river and vice versa, instead of going from the river down into the groundwater. So there seems to be very little concern from experts about these metals kind of making their way into drinking water. The Trampolo County Health Department, though, did put out a press release last Friday urging people to avoid touching if they see piles of this orange sediment underwater or on the ground somewhere. They say avoid touching it, and if you do touch it, you know, be sure to wash it off. And if you go swimming in the area downriver, be sure to wash up.
One other impact I want to talk about before we run out of time is the impact on agriculture in the area. During your reporting, you were able to talk to some farmers, and I've got a clip from your reporting that I want to play. This is Bill Silla, who you talked to just after the accident.
I don't know what I'm going to do with that land now. It's covered in orange slime. What is it? What do you do with it? Is anything going to grow in it? I don't know. The whole field isn't covered, but the section that is, I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, so Bill rents part of the land that was covered, and it was pretty stark. If you look at, you can find a picture online from our WPR news site. It looked, this is bright orange stuff. It's like the finest mud you can ever imagine. And the farm field that was covered, he farmed part of that, and he was concerned about whether or not he could plant his seed at the time. He'd already bought his seed, already paid his rent, so he wasn't sure if he was just going to kind of lose money on that part. Also with the metal concentrations, like before we got the results, there were a lot of concerns that there might be other toxic chemicals in there. The company says there isn't. The DNR doesn't seem to be finding any presence of other materials like that. But the question is, what happens with these high concentrations of metals? The company has been out there, I guess, vacuuming up the bottom of these creeks, of this creek, and trying to get rid of the slime or the leftover sediment. But that's a long process, and it's going to take a while. So long term, it's hard to say what will happen with that land.
Well, we're going to have to keep watching this story. Rich, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He was with us to talk about the aftermath of a spill from the Hyatt Crush frac sand mine in the city of Whitehall in May. Planning a household budget can be a difficult task, and for people living on the fringes of poverty, it can look impossible. That's where our next guest comes in.
After dealing with life as a low-income single mother, she started the group Positive Women for Change in Madison. They teach financial literacy to mothers facing adversity. Kia Stearns is the group's founder and president. Kia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about what got you started wanting to help women. What was your own story that got you into this?
Great question. I was a young mom who found myself being the sole breadwinner for a family. I had three children, and I became a parent at a very young age by default. And I found that most of the financial struggles that I faced were lessons learned as it relates to managing a household budget. And managing that household budget was primarily through trial and error. So I was a young mother with basically little to no income and no support from the second parent. And the adversities and trauma that I faced had an impact on keeping current on bills. I often had to choose which bills to pay each month. Unexpected costs would set me off into a seemingly spiral of debt, an uncontrollable spiral of debt. So I found myself having to pick and choose which bill to pay based on the basic needs in order to sustain my family. And because of that lived experience, and because of the fact that I had once been the person who needed resources in order to sustain my family, once I became a housing counselor, I was on the other side of the table and was able to give the advice to the people who needed services. So I had saw both sides of the table. And as a result of that, I encountered many people who were facing similar issues as my own. And for that reason, I thought it was important that this method of financial literacy and personal life skills was important to help women feel less isolated, to be in a safe and judgment-free environment, and feel safe and supported.
Well, I want to jump in and ask. I imagine that it's got to be tough for someone in the situation you were in and the people you work with now. Like, you're in that day-to-day grind, right, where you're worried about that one bill. It's got to be hard to say, how do I budget for, you know, next month or next year, much less tomorrow? Is that what you were in? Is that what a lot of people you work with are facing on the day-to-day level?
We primarily focus on those whose trauma or adversity has impacted their finances. And when I say trauma or adversity, I'm referring to those unexpected out-of-pocket expenses related to the adversity. The adversity could be an illness, a death in the family, a traffic matter, a flat tire, a toothache. Many things just come up, and then especially if you have little to no income, how do we handle those unexpected out-of-pocket expenses? And sometimes it makes stress upon not only the person who's providing for the family, but the stress trickles down onto the children and to the entire family. So, again, we address the needs of those who need to meet modest but critical financial goals and personal life skills.
So when you work with somebody in that situation, what kind of help do you give them?
What Positive Women for Change does is that we provide peer-to-peer coaching and a safe, supportive, judgment-free environment. Our peer coaching curriculum consists of setting goals with milestones for setting personal and financial goals. And the curriculum is something that I developed based on, again, my own lived experience. And some of the curriculum is based on what I've learned through the nonprofit management curriculum at Madison College and the human services program at Madison College. So what we do is we provide peer-to-peer coaching. And what we do is we set a timeline. We have our participants to sign a pledge agreement. We allow our participants to set their own financial goals. And what we do is we basically provide motivation, encouragement, referral to resources, and we reward our participants with a stipend that helps them meet a modest but critical financial goal. And when I say modest, our goal is to help them to reduce or eliminate debt by 80%. Ideally, we'd like to allow our participants to have a stepping stone, a pathway out of poverty. There's often no model from generation to generation for sole parent families, particularly women who are the sole breadwinners for the household. Our goal is to create that model for financial literacy and personal life skills for people facing or people in a crisis, or people whose income has impacted their finances. We reach out to experts for our educational events from financial institutions, and we do our peer-to-peer coaching. We'd like to have quarterly educational events. Again, we are 1 year and 4 months old. Thus far, we've hosted two educational events. Depending on funding, we'll determine if we're able to maintain quarterly events.
And what have you heard from some of the women you've worked with who you've provided that to help you just talk about? What kind of reaction do they have and what kind of results are you seeing?
Changing our spending habits or improving our spending habits. And when I say our, I'm referring to myself included. The participants are able to have a positive difference in their life. And after their coaching experience, participants feel more in charge of their own financial outcomes. They feel less isolated. They have a sense of purpose. And in many cases, they have gotten current on their bills, and some were able to stay in their homes, and some were able to understand the basic household budget. And it also empowers sole parent households, focusing on underserved women and helping them to regain their financial footage or financial security.
That's amazing. And you mentioned at the beginning that you try to provide a non-judgmental space. Why is that an important part of this for you?
Because often when an individual, a family, is struggling financially, we don't want people to know about it. And we hide it and we hold this in. On the outside, we may look as though we're not struggling, but inside, we don't want to share the struggles that we face. So the judgment-free portion is so that we don't have this isolated feeling. We'd like to address the issues of positive behavior changes while using coping strategies and identifying specific needs for this population.
And I imagine in the situation you were in and some of the women you've worked with, it sounds like it would be easy to feel trapped, right? You have that one unexpected bill, the flat tire, the toothache, whatever, and you end up in this spiral and you don't see a way out. Is that the big goal here, to give that path to get out of that trap?
It is. The way in which we feel that this is so very important is so that a person is able to at least be current on all of their bills or stay in their homes. And these goals, these financial goals, are critical in order to maintain the household budget. So that's kind of the gap we wanted to fill, is so that it doesn't continue to spiral. And we feel the skills that we encourage may prevent that cycle of poverty from repeating itself, because this is a model that can be passed down to the next generation.
And what's next for Positive Women for Change? What are your hopes for the project in the future?
Oh, that's a great question. Again, we do currently peer-to-peer coaching. Our goals, our future goals, is to have weekly group support. At our last event, just this past May, our survey results indicated that many people, some of the people preferred peer-to-peer, and many people preferred group support so that we could learn from each other in a supportive circle. So our goals are to increase the number of women that we serve and continue with the micro level of peer-to-peer, go to a macro level of weekly group support, and continue the meso level of the annual events.
If somebody's out there listening and thinking, hey, I have some skills along these lines, I know some stuff, are you looking for volunteers?
That's a great question. We are always in need of volunteers, and I encourage those who are interested in volunteering for Positive Women for Change to go to our website, go to contact, the contact page on positivewomenforchange.org, and introduce yourself, tell us about the skills you have that you might be able to share, and a way to contact you. Another way in which to volunteer for Positive Women for Change is through United Way's volunteeryourtime.org. So we have a profile there, and we have a needs list there. And so that's another way that people can get involved, either through our own website, positivewomenforchange.org, or United Way's Volunteer Your Time.
Kia, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kia Stern is the founder and president of the Madison nonprofit Positive Women for Change. It's a program that provides peer financial and life coaching for low-income women in Dane County.
Faced with the prospect of going out to dinner by yourself, is this how you imagine it going down?
Yes.
All right, do you have a table for dinner?
Certainly, sir. How many in your pot?
I'm alone.
Alone? Follow me, sir.
An awkward moment from the 1984 film The Lonely Guy. But not everyone approaches the idea of dining solo with that sense of dread. Maybe you love the idea of being able to focus on your food and people watch while you're waiting.
People tend to fall in one of two camps about doing things alone. We either love to be able to enjoy movies, meals, and even vacations all by ourselves, or we're more likely to stay home than go solo.
The thing is, with more than a quarter of Americans living alone and many people putting off marriage until later, a lot of us don't have that built-in companion to venture out with. But that raises the question for a lot of people, are we embarrassed to go solo or missing out if we don't?
Bella DiPaolo has been studying single people in American society for over 20 years. She's the author of Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After. In her TEDx talk, What No One Ever Told You About People Who Are Single Has Been Viewed More Than 500,000 Times. Bella, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great topic.
What a great topic indeed. And I want to start by asking you, why is it so terrifying for some people to go out by themselves?
Oh, you know, they think they're being judged. And I have to admit, the very first study I ever did on people being alone in public, which was 20 years ago, I thought the same thing. So we did this study where we took pictures of people alone and with other people in restaurants. And I thought, my colleagues thought, the people dining alone would be judged more harshly. And they weren't. It was so amazing. We collected people's responses, you know, what they thought about when they saw these various pictures. And it's not like no one ever said anything mean about the people dining alone, but they were just as likely to say snarky things about the couples. Like, you know, she's upset. They're going to have a talk because their relationship is mending. She went out to dinner with him out of obligation. She's married to him. So I think that we are just getting it wrong about how we think other people see us when we go out and about on our own.
So the takeaway is people are probably a lot less interested in us in our personal affairs than what we really think. Is that right?
They're probably a little less interested and less judgmental. Mm. I think that's the key part, you know. And it's true, interesting. You know, they're probably focusing on their own dinner, and if they're with somebody else, they're focusing on their own companion. But even if they do see you, they might be less judgmental. Or we also got some great responses from people who said, Wow, he just seems to be enjoying his dinner so much. Mm. Or my favorite one was someone who looked at a guy dining by himself and said, he is secure.
Mm. Well, and so you've been looking at this topic for a long time. Have you seen a shift from when you started to now in maybe more acceptable views, kind of like what you were saying, towards people who might be out there dining by themselves or doing by themselves? Are we getting better at looking positively at these people?
I think so. I don't know of a study that has actually traced that systematically over time, but it does seem to be getting more acceptable and even something that people yearn for and cling to. I mean, people who are in charge of travel agencies and people in the travel industry say solo travel is increasing greatly. And interestingly, it's not just by people who are single. Even people who are partnered sometimes travel alone just because they want that time to themselves. And I think that's one of the big things that's changing, is that more and more often we want our alone time, regardless of whether we're single or partnered or living with someone or not. And I think it starts with children who, if they're in a family where their parents can afford it, will give them rooms of their own. So they are already growing up expecting and getting used to having rooms of their own. And then they get to college, and it's not like, you know, the olden days where everybody got paired with a roommate. I mean, students are just clamoring to have their own room, at least in a suite.
I'm wondering, too, if
not all by themselves.
I'm wondering, too, if we see kind of like a hierarchy of things that people are willing to do, willing to go to by themselves. I think of myself, I'm willing to go to a coffee shop by myself, maybe sit there and read a book. Do I want to do the same thing at the bar? I'm a little more nervous about that. I'm wondering if we do have this hierarchy, and if so, where that comes from. Because really, at the end of the day, there's not too much of a difference between sitting at the coffee shop and sitting at the bar, except that one serves alcohol.
Right. That might make a difference. I think it's partly what is commonplace. So it's almost like restaurants. You might feel more comfortable going to lunch by yourself, but dinner, that's a little more iffy. And even there's a hierarchy of dinner experiences. So you might be willing to go to an informal restaurant on your own more readily than a formal one. And so part of it is just the expectations and norms about what going to a really nice restaurant is supposed to mean. And, you know, it got all bundled up with romantic themes or the other end of it, family night. So there's that. And then the more, and part of the normative part of it is what other people are doing. So if you're in a coffee shop, there are probably lots of other people there by themselves, so you don't feel so conspicuous. Whereas if you go out to a nice restaurant by yourself, there might not be as many people who are also there by themselves, although I do think that's increasing, too. That open table reservation format did a study, I think, a year or two ago, and they found that requests for reservations for one were increasing. Mm.
We are talking with Bella DiPaolo about why we like or don't like going out and doing things by ourselves. And Bella, I mentioned that example of me going out to a coffee shop. I'm sitting there. I'm reading a book. Maybe if I don't have a book, I'm scrolling through my phone. I'm not necessarily like present with what I'm doing and the people around me. I'm kind of in my own little world. You could look at it as I've got a shield in front of me because I've got something. Like I'm doing a task. And I'm wondering if we're more likely to go out and do these things if we have that other thing that we can focus on.
Yes, a couple of things about that. I think that's true. It is that shield. And I taught a course on single people in society, and one of the assignments was to go out to lunch or dinner alone. And my students were really into it, and so they changed the assignment. And they said it had to be dinner, and you couldn't bring any newspapers, you know, any of those kinds of distractions. You had to really do it. And the second point about that is by letting yourself get into all these distractions, you are depriving yourself of some of the most wonderful things about being on your own, which is getting to, you know, think deeply or not think deeply and just, you know, let your mind wander or kind of look out at the people or what's going on around you, or really savoring your food and your experiences. So that part of just letting yourself soak in what's happening inside you and around you when you're by yourself is a wonderful aspect of it. You know, the New York Times travel writer Stephanie Rosenblum has this new book out called Alone Time, and she has this great quote, which is, when you're out alone with no one else across from you in the I'm botching her quote, but anyway, when you're sitting alone, you're sitting across from the world.
Mm. You know, talking about this got me thinking of an experience I had a few years back where I had signed up for a tennis league with a coworker, and I'd never done this before, and I was all excited about it, and then the first night of the tennis league rolled around, he is deathly sick, he can't go. My first thought is, well, I guess I'm skipping it, I guess I'm not going. And then I thought about it, and I was like, well, okay, maybe I should go, maybe I should give it a shot, and that was an instance where I couldn't go, and I couldn't sit in front of the book, or I couldn't sit in front of my phone. I had to go there and swing the tennis racket around with people. And I actually found that it was a good experience because I was able to meet a couple new people, some of whom I still play with today. I'm wondering if this is a situation that you hear similar things from your students or other people that you work with often.
Yes, for sure. That it's the kind of ironic aspect of doing things by yourself is that you're more likely to meet new people. You know, instead of just hanging out with the person you went with and doing everything with them and all your conversations are with them, you're kind of open to other people. And yes, I've heard many stories about meeting people and staying in touch with them for years and years and years.
We are talking right now with Bella DiPaolo about flying solo and why doing things alone can be a great option.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you love to do things alone? Are you willing to do things solo if it's the only option? Or do you avoid being out on your own at all cost? If you enjoy being on your own, what about it appeals to you? If you don't, what holds you back? What freaks you out about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Bella DiPaolo about the advantages of doing things like eating out, going to a movie, or even taking a vacation by yourself.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. Do you like getting out and doing stuff on your own, whether it's the restaurant, the theater, maybe a road trip, or if it's the option of doing a thing by yourself or not at all, you go with not at all. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Bella, I had a hunch that we were going to hear from some listeners on this topic, and we've got callers lining up, so we're going to go right to the phones. Barbara in Appleton, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I just got back from a 3.5-week road trip by myself.
Wow.
I'll say that I am married, and I went by myself. My ultimate destination was in Florida to be with my mother, who has cancer. But I wanted to drive short distances all the way and stop in towns and cities that normally I would pass by, that I was always curious about. And I just had the best time. No matter where I was, I would meet people and talk to people and ask locals where's the best place to eat, what they like about where they live. I stayed in Airbnbs and met, you know, a couple from England, a couple from Germany. It was just the most amazing experience, and I would do it again in a heartbeat.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much for that call, and all the best to your mom. Bella, how important is it, hearing a story like Barbara's makes me think about, that had to have been something, she had to step outside of her comfort zone, I would imagine, especially with travel. How important is it, no matter who we are, to step out of our comfort zone, psychologically, every now and then.
It can be a good experience. And, you know, even if you do it and you don't have the wonderful experience that Barbara just described, you can still feel proud of yourself for trying.
Barbara, thank you.
People won't.
Barbara, thank you again for that call. We're going to go next to Lizzie in Madison. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Go right ahead.
Well, I had to call in because I'm in my 70s now, but once upon a time in my 20s, I was living in Japan.
Hmm.
And I met an American, and we were going to go from Tokyo to Moscow to Europe, and in 2 weeks, we were going to visit Europe. Well, at the last minute, she couldn't go, and I was about to say, well, I guess I shouldn't go either. This was in the 60s, and it was still the Soviet Union, and not Russia. And, well, I went by myself, and was on a Russian boat to Vladivostok. I was on the Siberian Railway by myself, and I was a very shy 26-year-old, and I just met so many interesting people. And then I got to Moscow, and I met a girl on the train, on the boat, so that we went around Moscow together. She was from Britain. And then from there, I went to Helsinki. I wasn't going to go that with my American friends. And then I went to Stockholm, and I went through Sweden, where my grandmother had been born, visited relatives for a couple of weeks in Malmö, and went all over Europe with people that my parents knew.
And Lizzie, I'm gonna jump in because I want to have Bella respond to this. You know, Bella, we're hearing stories about people who traveled the United States, traveled the world by themselves. But if you want to go out and have an experience by yourself, it doesn't need to be a major production, does it? Like, this is something that, you know, maybe someone could benefit from just going out and seeing a movie by themselves.
Yes, totally. Or going out to dinner, or just going somewhere locally. One of the things Stephanie Rosenblum did was to treat New York City, where she lives, like a tourist would, and she decided to go out and explore all sorts of places that she had never gone to before, to really get a sense of what it was like to explore New York City on her own. So, yeah, I think that's a wonderful thing. You can do mini trips, or, like you said, the movies, or going out to dinner, or just going to local culture or local events on your own, or even go a little further. I mean, take a train somewhere and go to the next stop and spend a nice day there.
Lizzie, thank you so much for that call. Let's keep going with callers now. Let's go to Jordan in Madison. Hi, Jordan.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I love going to music concerts and movie theaters by myself, because sometimes if my friend isn't having as much fun as I am, then it feels like I can't have as much fun. So I like going alone because it frees me up to have as much fun as I want to.
Jordan, thanks so much for the call, and I'm glad that you brought that up. Bella, something about going out and doing things by ourselves. We are in total control. We don't necessarily have to worry about whether or not someone is having a good time. We don't have to worry about where we're going to go to dinner. There's something to be said for like being the one to make all the decisions.
Yes, and you can be totally flexible. If something grabs your attention, you can follow that. If you get bored, you can go home. And, so I think that having that control over what you do and when you want to do it is a really nice thing about doing things alone. And I'm really impressed that he goes to concerts by himself. I mean, concerts are such a, you know, social kind of activity that I think that's great that he does that.
So we are talking about, you know, concerts, movies, travel, everything. You know, for some of us, this is right in our wheelhouse. For some of us, you know, we may have always felt, this is not really my thing. I don't know if I could do this. What are some just general tips that you could offer, some general advice to maybe make it a little bit easier for someone who feels uncomfortable to go out and try to experience something by themselves?
Yeah, I think it would be to start with the things that are less threatening. So if you want to learn to go out to meals by yourself, start with lunch, or start with off hours when not that many people are around, or start with places that are kind of informal, and then you can kind of build your way up after that.
And I'm also wondering, too, I've been seeing some news stories about restaurants and other establishments that are trying to make their eating areas a little bit more friendly to solo diners, places like that. Do you think that places like that have a role in being more welcoming to people who are there by themselves?
Sure, they can. Some of the things they offer are sometimes like community tables. So if you want to actually join in with other people, you can do that. Or some places offer those kind of defenses that we were talking about before. You know, they'll hand you a newspaper or let you do something like that. And I think also what they need to do is not assume that you want to be hidden. One thing that used to happen early on when I talked to people about this is they'd say, you know, if I show up by myself, they'll put me all the way in the back next to the swinging doors going into the kitchen. And I think we don't want that anymore, or not everybody does anyway.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Ruth next in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I just had a comment. I have been single for 18 years. I absolutely love being by myself. I'm somewhat of an introvert. I have traveled the world as a singleton, and I really enjoy it. What I have found so difficult is being with people who are always with their mobile phones. Mm-hmm. They're either sticking them in your face to look at pictures, or they're texting to someone. And I have found that really off-putting because I really love life around me, the trees, the wind, the breeze, the smell. And I just enjoy not having to be, maybe it seems a little selfish, but I just enjoy being on my own and doing my own thing.
And Ruth, we are running out of time, so we're going to leave it there. But Bella, this idea of just putting the phones down, putting the technology down, it sounds like this can be a great way to just to go out and disconnect for a little while.
Oh, absolutely. And when you have your phone, you're kind of, you're not getting the true direct experience of the world around you or the people around you. So I totally agree with Ruth. Everything except when she said she's selfish. She is not selfish. She's wonderful.
Well, that is a great place to leave it. Bella, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Bella DiPaolo has been studying single people in American society for over 20 years. She's the author of Singled Out, How Singles Are Stereotyped, Stigmatized, and Ignored, and Still Live Happily Ever After. She was with us to talk about why it can be great to go out and do things on your own.
And you can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and read what others have to say while you're there. Have you always been comfortable doing things on your own? If not, is that still true? You're not comfortable doing that? Or did you get to a point where you can enjoy yourself, enjoy your own company, and get out and do things alone? If you're not quite there yet, what are the obstacles? What makes it hard for you? Is there something you'd like to see, say, at a restaurant that would make it easier for you to dine solo? Share your stories, your experiences, maybe, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hey, spoiler alert, before you go online to read the latest update of the Oxford English Dictionary, and you know you were gonna, there are some new words and phrases in the mix, and one of them is spoiler alert.
Here's the official definition of spoiler alert: an intervention used to warn a reader that an important detail of the story is about to be divulged or alluded to, a forewarning of a plot spoiler.
And you might want that spoiler alert if you're about to do some binge watching. That's another phrase added to the dictionary this month. These are definitely part of human existence now.
Definitely part of human existence. And have you ever missed that spoiler alert? Have you ever just had a really bad spoiler that you've been really angry about?
I've had a lot of spoiler alerts. I don't get worked up. If I like the show, I'm still going to like it even if I know what's coming, I guess. I mean, people read Shakespeare, right? You kind of know how they end. Romeo and Juliet, spoiler alert. It ends poorly.
It ends poorly. Well, you know, we're surrounded by news all the time, and I see spoilers everywhere, and sometimes that's come back to bite me, and, oh, it looks like you've got...
All right, I'll retract my story, because sometimes you see the, in the pop culture, if you're flipping through headlines, in the headline of the story, there's something that spoils, like the shocking thing that happened in the episode, they haven't seen it. That should be barred.
I'm all for the coverage, but come on, the headline, come on.
That's a little too much. Spoiler alert, there's more to come. On Central Time. You knew that already, though.